Scripture is such that they're intended to make you stop and think. You know, it's not, I mean, all of the Bible you're supposed to be thinking about. But certain sections of the Bible, they have long narratives. The book of Proverbs, it tends to come at us in little short bits. And each one is to be thought about. And Proverbs tend to be, you know, each proverb is going to a certain degree, be a partial revelation of truth. You know, it's not the entirety of truth, but it's truth. And you have to think about it, and then you have to work them together with the others. And it's not about so much the law of God as the wisdom and the practical living out of God's law, basically timeless principles that I believe that by and large the book of Proverbs would have been true in the days of Cain and Abel, and Noah, Abraham. They were true in the days of Solomon, and they're true today. You know, obviously, maybe there are some agricultural type references telling the king, you know, look out for your flocks and herds, that would be a little different today, even though I think even in that there's a great lesson to be learned. But this is a book of just timeless principles to be lived out. And chapter 31, I put the virtuous wife, verses 10 through 31, is the kind of the final wrap-up of our study of the home. And remind you just again, don't just see the specific home passages is all that the book of Proverbs says about family, about marriage. You know, one of the things I do in teaching on marriage in the New Testament is to say that every passage that talks about relationships has application to marriage. It doesn't have to say a husband and wife. All the one another passages, they ought to be things that we apply as husbands and wives. In the same way, when he talks about the general instructions of wisdom, that, and Greg did a lot of this last Wednesday night, you know, about the wise versus the fool, the hard work, the tongue, the moral character. Those are things of husbands and wives that we need to remember. And we also, I want to just remind you again, at the bottom of your page, you've got the New Testament references. Those deal more specifically with roles in marriage that Proverbs doesn't do that much of, although I think it's pretty much assumed. Proverbs doesn't talk about the husband is to be the head of the family. He's to be the provider. The wife is to be... It operates from the assumption you know that. And, you know, so that's why it says, you better be a hard worker. Go to the ant, you sluggard. Learn from him. You know, take those things. But what I'm saying is, take those things, learn those laws, those characteristics, those things taught in the New Testament, and then use these great reminders. Applications, I would say. Proverbs 31:10-31. Remember what I said Sunday? It's an alphabetic writing. You know, I don't know, there's really little value to us in that when it went from Hebrew to English, it didn't keep that alphabetic structure. That was probably a way of helping them learn to memorize this. That you could remember this first sentence starts with Aleph. The next is going to start with Beth. The next with Gimel, with Daleth, and so on through the 22 letters. You translate it over, doesn't carry, but it's interesting nonetheless to know that. Let's read this. Who can find a virtuous wife? For her worth is far above rubies. The heart of her husband safely trusts her, so he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She seeks wool and flax and willingly works with her hands. She is like the merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She also rises while it is yet night and provides food for her household and a portion for her maidservants. She considers a field and buys it, From her profits she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and strengthens her arms. She perceives that her merchandise is good, and her lamp does not go out by night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hand holds the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor. Yes, she reaches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of snow for her household, for all her household is clothed with scarlet. She makes tapestry for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them, and supplies sashes for the merchants. Strength and honor are her clothing. She shall rejoice in time to come. She opens her mouth with wisdom, and on her tongue is the law of kindness. She watches over the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her. Many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her of the fruit of her hands, and let her own works praise her in the gates. Now, what is this woman's name that we're reading about? We're not given a name, are we? You know, I'm not even sure, you know, is this Solomon's little appendix at the end, or does this still belong to the words of King Lemuel at the beginning of the chapter? You know, I don't know that. I don't think we're supposed to see any one singular woman. This is an idealized portrait of this virtuous wife, this woman of excellence, this woman who is, you know, worthy, the King James says. This is the kind of person, and he said, she, her worth, oh, he said, you can't put a worth on that. You know, we say priceless. It's above rubies, it's above jewels. This is somebody, what did he say in chapter 18, 22? He who finds a wife, what? Finds a good thing and obtains favor from the Lord. When you have a woman like this, then you have got something worth far more than rubies of jewels. And it's something, as we'll see at the end, to be praised. Now, starting to break it down a little bit, you know, number 11 talks about her, and this is verse 11 also, the heart of her husband safely trust her. Well, a man ought to be able to trust his wife in every area. But what's the one thing he's really focusing on here? Or what? Well, virtue is, I think, but he said, so he will have no what? Yeah, it looks to me like when he's saying that the heart of her husband safely trust her, so he will have no lack of gain, that those two things aren't going together. That it has to do with her management of household finances. I mean, you've heard the expression that a woman can throw out the back door more than a man can bring in the front door. There are some situations like that. And then, of course, there are women who, you know, they're having to run out in the yard and drag in the money their husband's thrown out the door too. But here's a woman that she manages money well. She is able to make things work. What did chapter 22:7 say about the debtor? He's a slave to the lender. Was slavery a sinful thing to be in? No. You know, I don't take Proverbs 22:7 when it says the rich rules over the poor and the borrower is servant to the lender to mean that it's a sin to be the borrower who is a servant to the lender any more than it is to be the poor man who's ruled over by the rich. But do you want to be in a position where you've got the lender as your master? That you're not working for yourself anymore, you're working for him. Well, no. Borrowing is never depicted as the ideal thing, where you want to be. You would rather not. And so, putting that together. This husband, he's not out having to borrow money to cover because his wife's expenses. And, I just think this is for both husbands and wives. Learning to live within your means is an important quality. And it's, Peter warned about being, 1 Peter 4, about being a busybody in other people's matters. And it's important. People don't have to live my lifestyle. There is no one, the Bible doesn't give us a budget and say, you can only spend this much on clothes, you can only spend this much on groceries, you can only spend this much on a house, an automobile. So we have to be careful. But this man, he trusted her financial thrift, her ability to manage. And that's one of the things Proverbs encourages, is put yourself, use wisely. Make it work. Thoughts, comments? Okay, very good. Number 12, when did she rise up to provide food for her household? Well, it was still night. We saw a lot earlier, and we read a lot of the Proverbs about work. Go to the ant, you sluggard. I passed by the field of the sluggard, and it was all broken down. And over and over again, Solomon said, my son, get up, go to work, don't be lazy, plow your field now, plant it, harvest it. He worked the young man over and said, you better be a worker. And we tried to make the point that men, if you're going to provide for a family, you better learn to be a worker. And ladies, don't marry a lazy man. Well, here he says, ladies, the virtuous wife, she's a worker. Look at several of the verses that stress this. Verse 13, of course, she seeks wool and flax, willingly works with her hands. Verse 15, she's getting up before daylight to do her work. In verse 17, she girds herself with strength, strengthens her arm. She perceives that her merchandise is good. She put quality into what she did. Her lamp does not go out by night. You look at this. He say, she's up before daylight. She's still working long into the night. She stretches out her hand to the distaff. Her hand holds the spindle. Verse 24, she makes linen garments and sells them. Verse 27, she watches over the ways of her household, does not eat the bread of idleness. She wasn't lazy. She was a hard-working person. Making a house work is work. And ladies need to know that. They need to work. Husbands need to appreciate that when it's done. Going back to, I made the statement about ladies, don't marry a guy just because he's handsome, has a fast car, whatever. If he's lazy, he won't make a good husband. She can be beautiful. She can have all these, charming qualities. If she's lazy, it'll get old after a while. You need two hardworking folks. Just a quick aside, I had a great aunt that got married. We'll say she was 15, be generous. She may have been on the upper edge of 14 when she got married, but I think she'd hit 15 when she got married. And years later, some of them were asking her, why did you get married so young? She said, I was having to work so hard for Mama and Daddy, I thought it would be easier if I got married and left home. I think before the first week was up, she realized she had, now she stayed married and I think was happy with him, but she quickly learned that wasn't a very smart move to get married, to get out of work. Be a worker. There's no room for laziness at home or in the field, wherever you might be. Any thoughts, any anybody on that. All right. Number 13. What important decision did we find her making? She does some real estate. She considers a, verse 16, she considers a field and buys it. Does that mean she's usurping her husband's authority? Is she a rebellious wife here? Yeah. She's, 1 Timothy 5, verse 16, or 14, rather, verse 14, when he's talking about the widows, he said the younger widows are to marry, bear children, manage the house, the King James, New King James, I think the King James says rule the house. Ephesians 5, couldn't be any plainer about the husband being the head of the wife, wife being submissive to the husband. Titus 2, the wives to be obedient to their husbands. But that word manage, that's a position of trust. When you put somebody in a position to manage, again, what should a man be looking for in a wife? What should we be teaching our sons to look for? Qualities we should be teaching our daughters to develop. It's the ability. It's a willingness to work. And it's a trustworthiness, a sense of responsibility. This husband could trust that wife. He didn't have to make every decision. Part of what he was doing, verse 23, was sitting around with the old men telling stories about the weather. No. When it talks about him sitting, I heard somebody say one time, said, well, it looks to me like she's doing all the work and him and the old men are just sitting around. Sitting with the elders, he was a leader. He was a respected, he was like on the city council, to use our terminology. And she's a part of that. We think today, elders and deacons, and what's said about the wife. And so, this is a woman of responsibility. He trusts her in this. And so, these are qualities. The weaker vessel should not be treated as the dumber vessel. Man should find somebody whose judgment he can trust and put some trust in her. Well, look at her also. She's unafraid of the snow. Why was she unafraid of the snow? She was prepared for it how? She dressed her children in what? Scarlet. Now, the English Standard Version says that they were dressed in double thickness. The margin says double thickness, which would make good sense. Verse 21, but most of the translations go with scarlet. Scarlet was the finer stuff. She made sure her children, they were not running around ill prepared. Something I want to note in this that at least comes out to me is you look at this lady. In verse 20, she cared about the poor. She was not selfish. And she was not so absorbed in family that she didn't see to the needs of others. She even had, to some degree, a little business going on in verse 24 of making linen garments and selling them, supplying sashes for the merchants. But you go through this, and you look where, though, is the priority. What's number one with her? She was, verse 27, watching the ways of her household. She was providing food for her household. She was managing that house in a way that her husband could trust and endure. Her priority was home. It was family. Can you have a priority and still have some other interest and concerns? Certainly. Just as a man, he can have his number one concern is providing for his family and teaching his children. He might hunt and fish or golf or do something. He can have other interests. But it becomes clear over time where the priorities are. What's the priority of this virtuous, this excellent wife of valor, the margin says? It's home and family. And we need to make certain that we keep our priorities where they ought to be. Put first things first. Get that first. Let other things follow behind. Great lesson in that. Look at number 16. I like this question because if I thought about this before, I don't remember thinking about it before. You know, sometimes I'll be studying something and I'll have this great thought. I'm like, wow, the light comes on. And then I'm looking back over some old notes and the light came on 5 years ago and I wrote it down and I have forgotten that it came on then. You know, but yeah, at least y'all going, what's he talking about? Look at what it describes her clothing. Verse 22. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. The King James says silk. Most of your newer translations, fine linen. The most excellent of qualities, purple, the color of royalty. But look at verse 25. Strength and honor are her clothing. Okay, here's my light bulb moment for me. It wasn't truly, I won't say quite that dramatic, but 1 Peter 3, we often, and people get into discussions about 1 Peter 3, does this forbid any wearing of jewelry or, you know, a woman putting on makeup or, you know. Verse 3, do not let your adornment be merely outward, arranging the hair, wearing gold, or putting on fine apparel. Rather, let it be the hidden person of the heart with the incorruptible beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is very precious in the sight of God. For in this manner, in former times, the holy women who trusted in God also adorned themselves, being submissive to their own husbands. What did the excellent wife of Proverbs wear? Strength and honor. Some translations say dignity. It was a character. Oh, but she also wore nice linen, purple garments. She dressed nice. You know, she had nice outward attire on. But what was really special about her was this is a woman of true strength. And I don't think this had to do with how big her bicep was. This is a woman of character and dignity. And so when you come to 1 Peter 3, how the holy women of old adorned themselves, it wasn't that they didn't fix their hair. Or that they never had a nose ring, which they did. It was about character first. It's okay for a lady to look nice. It's okay for a gentleman to look nice. But the first thing is to be a lady. And that's not about gender. It's about quality of character. You know, a man, look nice. You know, in fact, if you don't dress appropriately for the occasion, calls into question one's character. You know, but it's not a either or. It's both. Thoughts, comments? I don't know why I'd never put the 1 Peter 3 and the Proverbs 31 together. I think they go together, at least. I hope I'm not doing something wrong there. Okay. Y'all are quiet tonight. I must be doing... I'm either doing such an excellent job explaining it, there's nothing else to be said, or I so muddy the waters, you don't even know where to jump in. You know, that's, what's on her mouth? What's on her tongue?
Law of kindness.
The law of kindness. She probably didn't do a lot of screaming and saying, I wish I'd have never had children! You know, probably didn't say things like that, did she? Probably didn't, you know, tell her husband, you know, if I'd have only married that Josiah, you know, he's got a bigger vineyard than you do, and he's got... Probably didn't say things like that. She was kind. You think, through the Proverbs, how many times our speech has come up? You know, how many times that quality has been developed? Why do you think he keeps emphasizing in Proverbs the tongue? What did James say about the tongue? Yeah, that's about the last thing anybody... If the man's got the control of the tongue, now that's the man you can say, he's got it all together there. Yeah, that's one of the most difficult things. You know, you conquer those lusts of the flesh. You conquer that desire for drink. You conquer that whatever it might be. And still that tongue. Especially the law of unkindness being on one's tongue. Saying things about people that you shouldn't say. That's hard. Oh, you know. And people remember our words. Now I know you think your children don't remember anything you ever say. I mean, like you tell them, clean their room. And they get big, I say, I forgot, you know, and sometimes they really do. You know, they don't jump on it immediately, they get busy and they forget. But I'll tell you, things you say that are of a slightly mean nature, things said in anger, they tend to remember those. There's probably not a one of us that hasn't said something to our husband, wife, children, that we wish we hadn't said. But think about it. And let's be more careful about it. To be careful about that law of kindness being on our tongue. Open your mouth with wisdom. That doesn't mean you always tell your children or your husband, oh, everything is good, everything's... No, sometimes you need some correction. But with wisdom. And with kindness. And when all of that, her children rise up and do what? Blessed. Her husband, he praises her. Oh, he says, many daughters have done well, but you excel them all. He says, and then this seems to be the added note, charm is deceitful and beauty is passing, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. You know, there's a, I don't know, to me, kind of a tension almost between bragging on people, honoring men to too great a degree. You know, especially when we have to avoid that. We don't want to elevate one man above another, and I mean one human above another. But when praise is due, we need to praise, and we need to commend. And here, to our mothers, and to our wives. You know, and no, you know, they may not be all of this in every single way because, you know, in fact, my mother, she didn't have a household servants. My wife has not had the privilege of having those either. You know, this is the wife of a very wealthy man, you know, as it's pictured here. But we need to praise and show our appreciation to them. It's something that we don't always do, but needs to be done. Thoughts, comments on this section of Scripture before we move to the next lesson. Any wrap-up on husbands, wives? All right. Very good. Let's turn to more wisdom to consider the next lesson, where we just cover everything we didn't cover in the topical lessons. Proverbs has a lot of one line, and we won't cover all of them in this. But we're going to cover some of them. And look at number 2, and I will be skipping over some. I'll be adding in verses that I don't have questions on. But what happens to one who refuses correction? According to chapter 10, verse 17. He goes astray. Anybody else have a different translation? Have a different answer? He what? Leads others astray. Look at chapter 10, 17. This is the New King James I'm reading from. He who keeps instruction is in the way of life, but he who refuses correction goes astray. But the English Standard Version, as Nathan's, it's got leads others astray. And I was about to say, I'm not qualified to tell you which Hebrew translation of the Hebrew is correct. And I mean, like, if I had studied a lot of Hebrew, I'm going to overrule one set of scholars. You know, what you've got is a committee of men with the New King James said they believe this verb indicates you yourself go astray. Others said they lean toward leading others astray. And the truth is, both are going to happen. You lead others astray because you yourself have gone astray. And the key thing he says is refuses correction. We're not all going to get it right every time. And we've got to be willing to be corrected. Look at chapter 17, verse 10. Rebuke is more effective for a wise man than 100 blows on a fool. What is it we say? Our little proverb, a blank to the wise is sufficient. A word to the wise is sufficient. You tell that man, he listens. He said, you know, you got this fool and you're beating him and beating him and beating him trying to get him to listen. He said, a wise man, you tell him he's wrong, you show him where he's wrong, he will change. He won't get angry. He won't say, well, who are you to talk to me about this? He won't blame others. He'll listen. Proverbs is a great book, but it is a book that if you deal with it honestly, it'll get at you at times. It'll make you think, am I that guy? Am I that person who's willing to accept correction? Or do I get my back up and I immediately, when somebody starts to tell me I'm wrong, do I get defensive? Do I start looking for something in them that I can attack and say, well, what about this in your life? You know, be careful here. That's something we need. I want to say more about pride in number 4. But look at number 3. Number 3. He says, the days of the wicked will be shortened. Verse 27, the fear of the Lord prolongs days, but the years of the wicked will be shortened. Is it always that way? Do the wicked always die at a young age? No. Do the righteous always live long, full lives? Well, we know better than that, don't we? Yeah. If you're thinking about eternal, and I think that's always going to be, but I'm not sure that here, I tend to think, you know, as so much of Proverbs, he's looking in this life and the consequences. You know, Ephesians 6, what's the first commandment with promise? Honor your father and mother that what? You may live long on the earth. Obedient children. You know, or let me just put this way. Do disobedient children stand a greater chance of shortening their life? Oh, yeah. I mean, what parent has ever told their child, I want you to go out here and I want you to drag race on some backcountry road, see if you can get your car up to 120. You know, and then they end up wrapped around a telephone pole. Excuse me, electric pole. We don't have telephone poles anymore. We bury those underground. But anyway, you know, but it's the disobedient child that's doing that. It's the disobedient child that's drinking. It's the disobedient child that's shot while involved in an armed robbery. You know, that's, as we say sometimes, in the wrong place at the wrong time. Doesn't mean every disobedient child suffers that kind of fate? You know, any more than, you know, in chapter 1, when he's talking about the evil ones, and he says, you know, don't walk in the way with them. You know, verse 18, they lie in wait for their own blood. They lurk secretly for their own lives. It doesn't mean every time a gang gets together, they end up turning on one another. But it happens an awful lot. It happens so many times. This is the way to the better life. It's listening to God. Now, Brother Crowley pointed out, you know, even if you somehow defeat the odds in this life, you know, and you know, you live the worst of lives, the most ungodly, immoral, rebellious life, and die at 115, you're going to be cut off in eternity. And if you die young as a righteous person, you'll live forever with God. But I think the life God gives the child of God is a good life. It's a life of peace and safety. You know, are you worried about... are you worried about the government coming and knocking on your door with guns? Increasingly, some of us are, but you know, I see a blue light. All I think about is I need to get out of the way and let him go after the person he's after. I'm not worried. I know you're the same. You don't live in fear of the police. You don't live in fear of these things. Yes, we run the risk of the so-called drive-by shooting, the innocent, you know, being caught in the crossfire. But in cities with the highest murder rates, a very small percentage are innocent people. And I don't mean the folks that get killed deserve to die. But so often it's people who themselves are involved in some of the same things that they're murderers involved in. It's one drug dealer shooting another. It's establishing turf. The life of a Christian is a life of peace and safety. It's a life that... Look at the third psalm. I didn't write this down. I hope I have the right number in my mind. David says in verse 5, this is when he fled from Absalom, I lay down and slept. I awoke, for the Lord sustained me. I will not be afraid of 10,000s of people who have set themselves against me all around. A child of God can go home and sleep tonight. And I think that's a good thing.